Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
It's the fall, so we know we're going into virus season. Well, we're kind of fully in it already. And you're all pretty familiar with whooping cough, right? You've heard of pertussis before, also known as whooping cough. It's a pretty serious, highly contagious respiratory illness. And while there's a vaccine available for whooping cough, according to national studies, only 30% of adults in the U.S. have received it in the past 10 years. In fact, those living with asthma are four times more likely to have increased risk of the infection and complications if diagnosed with whooping cough. So I wanted to talk about it a little bit more this morning with Dr. Philip Sinkovitz, who is a pulmonary disease specialist at Hartford HealthCare's St. Vincent's Medical Center. Dr. Sinkovitz, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you today, Melissa?
I'm doing fine, thank you. So first of all, Doc, I've never actually had whooping cough before. For people who are not familiar with this or how severe it is, could you talk a little bit about it?
So whooping cough, as you pointed out, is a very contagious respiratory illness. It currently seems to occur more randomly in batches. It has three phases. The first phase is really identical to a common cold with a stuffy, runny nose, some periodic cough, and just a feeling of unwell, muscle aches. At about 5 to 6 days, whooping cough switches to more the classic whooping cough where it becomes a little bit harder to take a deep breath in. You make that high-pitched sound when you breathe in, called the whoop, and the cough becomes more paroxysmal and more severe. And that's when people start to realize this is something different than a cold. And that, you know, can last anywhere from 5 days to about 3 weeks.
Wow.
And then people can go into a more chronic kind of prolonged annoying cough phase, and that can last for up to a total of 100 days, which is why whooping cough is called the 100-day cough.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even know that. That's just terrible. Now, I'm curious, Doc, is this something that you have to catch from somebody else, or could you be more prone to getting whooping cough?
No, people get it from other people.
It is
a contagious disease, but it's very easily caught from other people, which is why it occurs in these outbreaks.
So only because I'm trying to think, like, then who could be the source? Like, so we enter into the fall. I would imagine, is this when we start to see more cases of whooping cough?
Well, you're always going to see more respiratory viral illnesses in fall and winter when we go inside and we're closer to other people. You know, there isn't the air to spread things out.
Okay. So to develop it, though, you know, you only could get from somebody else. But, like, in my family, my kid obviously goes to school, but before that, he really wasn't seeing anybody. How could he get it, or how could we get it? It could literally be like if you're at the grocery store, if somebody else went through there. Like, is it that contagious? Sorry if I'm sounding really annoying. I'm just trying to understand it.
No, it is that contagious, and so it can be from a fairly minor exposure. Why you don't hear of that many people having whooping cough is it's really not that prevalent a disease, but you can get it from a very minor exposure. And why we continue to see this is, as you pointed out in your introduction, the lack of vaccination. And as people are not getting regularly vaccinated for whooping cough, it isn't completely eradicated and it is endemic. Throughout the country, throughout the world, even.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Dr. Philip Sinkovitz this morning, and we're talking about whooping cough. Now, Doc, I know that there's a vaccine available. Is this something that you get when you are a child? Is this something that you get almost like a flu shot, like you're supposed to get it yearly, if people aren't familiar with the vaccine?
Yeah, so um, the you get it as a child. It's a series of five shots that people get as a child, age 2 months, 4 months, 16 months, somewhere between 15 months and 18 years, and then 4 to 6 years. It is not a yearly shot, but it does not last forever. So after 10 years, we feel that immunity wanes. So, you know, frequently it is recommended for kids going to college, because that's when their immunity from their childhood shots wane. And it's recommended for adults every 10 years because of that immunity waning.
Okay. So this is something that your doctors will recommend that you get, right? Like they'll remind you, hey, you're due for a whooping cough vaccine.
They should. You know, I think as whooping cough, again, is not particularly prevalent, you know, sometimes the doctors in the space of having a limited time to see patients might talk about things that are more prevalent and might be causing more problems. I think where we see currently the big push and the big change is for people who are going to become grandparents and parents because of the danger to babies, and it really is get more ill with whooping cough, and they have no immunity whatsoever. We don't want the parent or the grandparent to be a source of the disease and give it to the baby who can become seriously ill, and there is even a fatality rate in babies.
Yeah, that's so true. So it's something that people should be aware of. Certainly, if you are not going to your annual doctor's appointments, this is another reason that you should be doing that. And I know if there are any new children on the way, certainly for parents and grandparents, it's something you should be asking the pediatrician about. Am I vaccinated? I should get vaccinated right away to make sure that those young babies don't, God forbid, get whooping cough, because it can be really serious. Dr. Simkovitz, I really appreciate you coming on. Is there a place where people can go if they want to learn a little bit more about whooping cough?
You know, like everything now on the internet, there is access about whooping cough. Mayo Clinic has some information published. The CDC has information published. And then, obviously, your doctor is a very good source of information.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, HartfordHealthcare.org, not a bad place to check out either. Dr. Simkovitz, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
No problem. You have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Fighting against injustice across Connecticut, Melissa in the Morning checks in with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities on WICC 600.
So according to national data, in 2021, the working population ratio for people with disabilities ages 16 to 64 years of age increased by 31%. Okay, that sounds great, right? However, the ratio for persons without a disability in that same age group increased by 72%. So what does this tell us? Well, it tells us that while we are focused on adults with disabilities and getting them into job market placement and getting them involved, we are still kind of missing the mark a little bit. And so I'm glad that we have awareness months like this month, where it's Disability Employment Awareness Month, and we're talking about it with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Robin Fox is here, actually, to chat with us. And good morning to you, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. So first of all, Robin, give us a snapshot, because that's national data. But here in Connecticut, how do we do with really giving opportunities, creating opportunities, and creating employers who are open to having staff members who are considered disabled?
It's a really good question. In every state, obviously, as you said earlier, the number of people, the percentage of people with disabilities who are employed is much lower than the percentage of people without disabilities, and that's not a good thing. Most people do want to work. Connecticut has a lot of resources through the Department of Labor. They have job centers, a group called Disability in Connecticut, that helps employers to support people with disabilities. There are legal organizations that help people to get reasonable accommodation so that they are able to work with their disabilities, such as Disability Rights Connecticut and other organizations. For employers that, you know, want to hire people with disabilities and want to, you know, make those accommodations but don't know how, there are resources online. There's a great group called AskJan, AskJan.org, which if you just put in the type of disability someone has, they make suggestions for accommodations. And again, through the Department of Labor, there are a lot of organizations that are looking to work with employers. And as an employer, it's required by law to make a reasonable accommodation to enable someone who is otherwise qualified to do the job to be able to do the job when they have a disability.
Now, so it's interesting, Robin, because my listeners know me pretty well, that I have a younger brother who's on the autism spectrum, and I've talked about him several times. And, you know, and sometimes I'm always thinking when I hear disability, I think of him. But there are also people like who maybe have had a physical ailment, or maybe they, I know there was a woman I worked with at my television station in Vermont, and she was a huge advocate in doing more for people who have disabilities because she lost a leg during her cancer treatments. And she felt, you know, while her employer was great, a lot of people that she connected with who also, you know, lost limbs for whatever reason did not have those opportunities like in the state of Vermont where we were living. So there, wouldn't you say there are a lot of people who actually fall under the category of what would be a disabled worker?
Yes. I mean, about one in four workers has, or one in four people has some type of disability.
Wow.
Whether that disability is visible, such as missing a limb, or is invisible, like a psychiatric disability or a learning disability, it's a sizable percentage of the population. And that's why it is so important that we have programs and employers are flexible and work with people to integrate them within the workforce. This year, the theme for the National Disability Awareness Month is disability part of the equity equation, because, you know, we talk about equity and often it's based on race and color, which is obviously extremely important, but also disability, because people with disabilities are so frequently left out.
I have a question for you, Robin. Is anxiety considered a disability?
It can be. Connecticut has a different definition for disability than the federal law.
What's Connecticut's definition?
Connecticut's definition is, if it's defined in the DSM, I think they're up to five now. So the DSM-5, or whatever the latest version of the DSM is. So if you've been diagnosed with anxiety by your treatment provider, then yes, it is something that would be covered under Connecticut law.
Interesting. Yeah, I was curious about that. And actually, later on this week, we're going to talk about how anxiety is in more Americans than people realize with one of our local doctors. I was also curious, Robin Fox, who's here with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities, what can people look for at their jobs if they believe their disability is the reason they're being discriminated against? For example, maybe they're being left out of projects that the company is doing, or maybe they are not being picked to lead, you know, something or be involved with a team because they have a disability. Like, even though they were hired to be on staff, they feel they're being discriminated against. How can you prove that? Or what should be some red flags people look for?
Yeah, that's hard, because there are a lot of different reasons why someone may be chosen to lead a project or to be on a team. But if your HR department, or, you know, if you have an EEO office, an Equal Employment Opportunity office at your company, you may want to, you know, touch base with them and let them know what you're feeling. If anyone tells you, you know, we have had cases at the commission where someone said, well, you know, we think this is going to be a little too much for you, so we're not going to put you on this project because maybe you have anxiety or something, and we don't want to stress you out, that is clearly a red flag, and, and you can, you know, you can file a discrimination complaint with CHRO if you're being excluded from things because of your disability. Sometimes it's hard to point out exactly what the reason is, and then, you know, see how, you know, maybe the first time you're not included and other people are, okay, you know, express your interest, continue to work on it. But if you're continually being excluded from these types of projects, then it may be something you have to file a complaint about.
We are chatting this morning with Robin Fox, who's with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities, talking about Disability Employment Awareness Month. Really quick, Robin, before we go to recommendations from the commission, do people have to tell their prospective employers that they have a disability?
To report that to your employer or to a prospective employer. However, if you need an accommodation to do your job, then you do have to let them know that the accommodation that you need is because of a disability.
Okay, but by law, here in Connecticut, like if I'm dyslexic, I don't have to I don't have to tell my employer that I'm dyslexic.
You don't.
Okay.
However, if you can, if your job, say, requires a lot of reading, and you can see that's going to be a problem for you, if you don't tell your employer that you have dyslexia and then they criticize your job performance because you're not reading fast enough or not reading accurately enough, then they can, you know, do whatever discipline an employer might do for not doing a good job. Whereas if you disclose your disability and discuss the possibility of accommodations, they may have to provide certain accommodations for you.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. And then my last question for you, Robin, is from the commission standpoint, what do you think Connecticut is doing well, and where do you think we're coming up short?
We have been, over the last number of years, expanding definitions of disability and the types of disabilities that are covered. For example, one of our statutes that had allowed an employee to recover damages for discrimination based on certain protected classes did not used to cover mental disability, and that has been added now to that statute. So that is a good thing. We've also added domestic violence, which I know is a different issue, but to our protected class status. So that's been something that we've been doing well. I think there are always ways that we can improve, making affordable housing work into the equation so that people can afford to live here and work. And just providing supports as well to employers, which so that they can not, so that they don't worry as much about potential costs of making reasonable accommodations. Most accommodations cost nothing. Many are under $500, statistically, and that's nationwide. And there are tax credits that are also available for employers who do have to expend funds to employ people with disabilities. So it really should be, and it is, a win-win for everyone. If, you know, employers get a dedicated employee, employees get jobs that they can then afford to participate in the life of their community.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and Robin, I'm curious from the postgraduate, and I think you and I have talked about this before, but how about, you know, students who become young adults who have either special needs or disabilities? Are we creating enough opportunity for them, you know, enough, I would say, just different options than what, like, the generic entry level jobs would be for them? Are we doing a good enough job to help them explore really a lot of different options in the work world here in Connecticut?
That is a good question, and I don't really know the answer to that. There's never enough, that then there's always more that can be done to help people explore these opportunities through internships, job training programs, and things like that. You're right. It shouldn't be just bagging groceries. Not that that is not an important job. And
right.
Needed,
I want to reiterate that there are plenty of people who love, like you said, love, you know, working at grocery stores. And again, I'm not putting that down. But I know for like my brother, for example, when he was given a list of the jobs he wanted to do, he wanted to work on a golf course. That's what he wanted to do. And there were, and that was very, when he graduated, you know, again, this is over a decade ago, but it was very like, oh no, that's going to be too hard kind of for you to manage a pro shop, or that would be too hard for you to manage customers coming in who want the utmost amazing experience at these golf courses. And so he bailed. I mean, he left Connecticut. My brother has not been here for 10 years. He lives in Florida because it was so, it was just so poo-pooed, his idea of what he thought he was capable of doing, and he's been doing it. But it wasn't, you know, it just didn't seem that way, you know. And again, I'm talking, you know, back in the mid-2000s. So I would hope that we've grown since then. I know he's only one example. I'm sure there are many people who have thrived. But that's why I always ask, like, if we're doing enough for post-grads and creating opportunities for them. That's not just the generic entry level, that even any adult, you know, is also going to get those opportunities. That's all.
No, and that is hopefully working through, you know, like I said, DOL has some, Department of Labor has some organizations and entities through disability in, you know, to bring people into the workforce. And I do hope that we are doing much better than we were.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
Robin,
in the last decades.
Yeah, I really appreciate having you on, and I appreciate that the commission brings awareness to Disability Employment Awareness Month here in Connecticut. And I just thank you. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, and have a good day.
Thank you, you too. That is Robin Fox here on WICC. So you may have missed it going into the weekend, but on Friday, CBIA, which is the state's largest business organization, issued a response to the release of the second quarter GDP and personal income growth data, which was released by the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. Just to give you a quick little synopsis, here's what the CEO and president of CBIA said. Quote, "Today's release of the GDP numbers clearly highlights the impact the state's labor shortage crisis, along with inflation and supply chain bottlenecks, is having on our economy." Let's just say, it wasn't so good, guys. Not a great report card. So to give us a little bit of insight into what this means, what you need to know about it, we have Senator Ryan Fazio back on the show with us this morning. Of course, Senator Fazio oversees the 36th district here in Connecticut, which is the towns of Greenwich, North Stamford, and portions of Stamford and New Canaan. So good morning to you. Senator Fazio, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm great, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So first and foremost, Senator, I know you're going to be joining other small business owners and lawmakers, actually, later on this morning in Stamford to talk more about this. What was the biggest takeaway from this recently released report?
Well, it was a very unfortunate report, but it reflected what I think a lot of people know on the ground, which is that Connecticut's economy is hurting. It's especially tough in this state. Obviously, people across the country are hurting, but Connecticut's economy has been suffering far more than most. So the report said that Connecticut in the second quarter of this year had the second worst economic growth of any state. It had the worst personal income growth of any state. And now at two straight quarters of negative growth, we're essentially facing a recession in this state. So something needs to be done. I mean, people in leadership need to understand that there's a problem, and there's a problem with the policies and the leadership that we have regarding the economy in this state. And so there needs to be a change in direction. And I'll be calling a press conference today in Stamford, which is the biggest economy in the state and the most important economy in the state, with small business owners. The state's especially punitive to small businesses, which are the backbone of our state's economy, which employ the majority of the people in this state's economy. But at the same time, we've seen policies piled up on top of one another that have made it very, very difficult for small businesses. You know, big businesses can handle high taxes and high regulation much better because they have the lawyers and the accountants and the lobbyists. But small businesses have no such luxury. So we have to make sure that we have policies that are supporting them.
Senator Fazio, were you surprised when you heard this report? I mean, this is one of the steepest declines in the nation.
Unfortunately, I wasn't very surprised. Connecticut, you know, even before this report, Connecticut was one of just four states in the country that haven't recovered from either of the prior two recessions before we entered another one. So, you know, every single economic sign that I've seen over many years have pointed to the fact that the leadership and the policy in this state have made it very difficult on the middle class and the working class and small businesses. And, you know, there's kind of a, you know, pathological insanity in the leadership in this state where they try the same thing over and over again and expect different results. New taxes, new regulations, more bureaucracy. Instead of lifting the burdens of government on small businesses and the middle class. That's why I ran for office in the first place. Because I thought the economic management of this state's been atrocious. But there's no reason that the economy in this state shouldn't succeed fantastically. We have the third highest rate of education of any state in the country. We have great people, great communities, relative safety, great location, natural beauty. I mean, why isn't this state's economy flourishing? The best answer, the only answer I can come up with is bad policy and bad leadership. And so we need a change.
So we're talking to Senator Fazio this morning, and some really, really troubling results came out of the second quarter, this report that's really showing some declines, you know, not just in our economy, but with job growth and things like that. And you know what's interesting about this, Senator Fazio, is the fact that if you talk to Governor Lamont, or really if you talk to most Democrats, they're going to say that we had an amazing surplus, that we have made tax cuts, and the other thing that you'll see, too, is that Governor Lamont, I feel like every other day I see a press release of, you know, we're welcoming another corporation, another business into Connecticut. We're boosting our economy. So there's a confusion, I think, from the public's standpoint. You know, if you're an everyday person and you're just reading the paper or you're just going to work and you're not really seeing the everyday politics that are going on, it can be very confusing. And I guess, could you respond to that? You know, what does that mean when you've got one side that's saying, listen, we are creating all these jobs and wow, we're doing really well considering we came off of the pandemic. But then you have another side that's saying, look at the numbers. We're not doing that well. It's very unaffordable to live here. And we're destroying the middle class. Like, how do we have two sides so polar opposite still, like, work? I don't know. Does that make sense what I'm asking?
It makes absolute sense. And I think if I had, you know, tens of millions of dollars, $30, $40 million to spare to run TV commercials, I could probably make you believe a lot of things about a lot of things, regardless of whether they're true. Mm. But the facts are in the statistics, and they're in everyday life. I mean, again, the second lowest rate of economic growth of any state in the country is what the federal government said about Connecticut on Friday. The lowest rate of personal income growth of any state in the country is what the federal government said about Connecticut on Friday. And when I talk to small business owners, when I talk to middle class and working class families every single day, as I do in office or on the campaign trail, to a T, they say it's too expensive in this state. You know, if they're you know, have kids who are getting older who are graduating high school, they say there is no reason for me to retire in this state or stay in this state if my kids are no longer in school. You know, I'm looking to move to South Carolina or Florida or something like that, where the taxes are lower and where it's less expensive. I mean, and that's to say nothing of the budget surplus and the very, very minor, narrow tax reductions that we saw this year. I mean, every single state in the country saw a budget surplus and reduced their taxes, every single one, because the federal government spent trillions of dollars in deficit spending, giving money to the states, and the inflation has resulted in over-collection of taxes by every state. And yet, you know, the only tax cuts that this state could manage were extremely narrow and particular in their scope rather than broad-based and for everybody. I mean, that's why our Senate Republican caucus offered an alternative tax cut which was twice as big and which would have actually affected every family in this state rather than just narrow constituencies. Mm-hmm. We could do so much better in this state. And anyone who says, you know, things are going great for the middle class in this state, you know, man, they're subscribing to the exactly wrong narrative, and they're buying into tens of millions of dollars of ads, which just aren't based in reality.
So in the day ahead, Senator Fazio will be joined by area small business owners and state lawmakers outside the Stanford Government Center for a press conference to talk about how Connecticut's economy shrank by almost 5% during the second quarter of 2022, one of the steepest declines in the nation. Here's my question for you, Senator Fazio. If the proof is in the pudding, regardless of all of the commercials that are out there, I think, because at the end of the day, Senator Fazio, like, I know for myself, I would be lying, and my audience knows this, I would be lying if I told you that I have not debated ever since moving back to Connecticut leaving, because it is so unaffordable to live here on a dual income with only one child, might I add, and putting him in public schooling. Yeah. Like, it doesn't matter. I mean, we still live almost paycheck to paycheck. And so with that being said, why is Connecticut so Democrat heavy? And the reason I say that is not for political reasons, but because it does tend to be, if you listen to both sides, you've got the Democratic Party that is very focused on people who live below the poverty line, which, okay, that's fine. But it seems like the Republicans are more focused on the middle class, which to me would be the majority of Connecticut. So why do we continue to see a Democratic majority in Hartford and even as our governor? Like, it doesn't make sense to me. Is it because we see a mass exodus of people who are like, hey, you know what? I just can't afford it. I'm leaving. Or do we just stay stuck in our ways? Like, what? I don't understand.
Well, first, I'm laughing because as if on cue, of course, I heard another ad on the lead-in.
I know you did. That's why I said it.
Contradict reality. And you know, it's not a coincidence. It's just that the ads are everywhere.
Right.
But again, if you have $30 or $40 million just to mess around with in a given campaign, I could make you believe that I'm 10 feet tall. But listen, I think, you know, politics and political beliefs have strong inertia, and I respect that. I respect you know, what the voters in the state believe. And, you know, even though this is just, you know, like most New England and Northeastern states, a state that leans Democrat, I think we do have to acknowledge that the voters in Connecticut are willing to clearly give Republicans a chance on the state and local level, traditionally. I mean, again, since I've been alive, yeah, so basically the past 30 years, Republicans haven't lost a gubernatorial race by more than 3 points in a state where they've lost every presidential election in that time by much more than that. So on the state and local level, voters are clearly willing to give Republicans more of a chance than they are on the federal level. So I think voters, even though they're in Connecticut, they're instinctually left of center, you know, in the same way that voters in Wyoming are instinctually right of center. Voters are still willing to give Republicans a chance on the state and local level. So I appreciate that. I also think that this party in this state, my colleagues in the Republican caucus in the Senate, the state Senate, and the same for the Republicans in the state House, are laser focused on serving their constituents, reflecting their constituents, and on solving the big problems in front of our state, including the economy, including public safety, including things like local control and ensuring that we have great schools. So they also want to reflect and represent specifically the people of this state. I think that if something keeps happening over and over again, you got to try a different result. And I think we have good candidates up and down the ballot this year. Whether it's for the state legislature, all the way up to the governorship. And I think that Connecticut Republicans can deliver a better way, and it will work very hard for the voters of this state in order to turn this state around and ensure that we have economic opportunity for all people. So I do think there is a better way, but I also do respect the democracy in this state and the will of the voters as well.
Senator Fazio, I know you're going to talk more about this in Stamford later on this morning at 11 o'clock, but I thank you for coming on our show before that happens on WICC. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a great day.
All right. Thank you, you too. That is Senator Ryan Fazio of the 36th District here on WICC.